It is April the 6th, or Tuesday, April the 6th, 2021. I am Patrick Crozier.
I'm Brian Micklethwaite.
And we're going to talk about Enoch Powell.
Yes. Well, you've been reading a big book on the subject, haven't you? I've been flicking through a couple of small books I possess on the subject, but not very attentively. So, this book, what's it like? Is it a good book? And who's it by and everything? Give us the details.
It's Simon Heffer's biography, which was published shortly after Powell's death in 1998. It's a very long book. I don't know if that makes it good, but it's very long. And it's certainly quite enjoyable. And it's as comprehensive probably as any biography is ever going to be of the man. And I think what really strikes me about Powell is that, first of all, you have someone who's very intelligent, to the extent that he's probably the smartest man in the House of Commons at any stage. He's also incredibly hardworking. I find it just amazing that he has had the time in his parliamentary career to write a history of the House of Lords and various other activities, including, I think he figured out that a tomb in King's Langley was intended for Richard II or Richard I or something like that.
And it's agreed that he was right about this, is it?
I'm not sure it's agreed. It might not be. But
he had time to think about it.
Yes, indeed. And the other thing that really comes across is this is a man who was not scared of being isolated. As far as he's concerned, if he'd figured something out, then that was it, and he would say it.
Yes.
Almost no matter what the consequences were. I would say that is he a libertarian? I think not. I don't think he would use that term himself, or would ever have used that term himself.
No, neither would I.
I wouldn't
describe him thus, based on what I recall of his public pronouncements.
I think certainly on economics he would count as a libertarian.
Yes.
He was consistent.
Well, he was the precursor of Thatcher, wasn't he, in lots of ways?
Yes.
As far as economic policy was concerned.
I think he did Thatcher a world of good, because what he did in the 1960s... Now, when people think about Powell in the 60s, or Powell at all, they think about the Rivers of Blood speech. I'm sure we'll get onto that. But in the 60s, his main sort of angle was attacking government economic policy.
Yes.
And his main focus was inflation. And he kept on banging on about saying, look, inflation is government's responsibility. It's not the responsibility of trade unions or people having too large pay increases or anything like that. It is the responsibility of government. And it took an awful long time for that idea to percolate through, well, sort of 10, 15 years, but Margaret Thatcher got it very strongly. So,
The two books I possess are both paperbacks, and one of them sold new for 80 pence, and the other one sold new for 40 pence.
Maybe that's all they're worth.
And the yellow one is 40 pence, and it's bigger, but it's earlier.
Yes.
So, you don't need to look anywhere beyond the covers of these books to see inflation. But, of course, that makes the point that inflation itself has raged on ever since, hasn't it? So he was partially successful in putting the arguments on the map, but not in the sense that the arguments won.
I mean, just on a day-to-day basis, I think the inflation rates we suffer today are much more tolerable than in the 70s.
Yes. Yes, I remember being truly frightened at the very end of the 1970s by what was happening to the price of a cup of coffee. That was where I remember seeing it. It went up from seemingly overnight from 10p to 30p, and I remember thinking, this has got to stop, which, of course, is exactly what Margaret Thatcher said.
Yes.
So, yes, I agree with this. As I say, I didn't read these two books. I got thoroughly, but what was striking was the presence of large amounts of commentary in them and speechifying, exactly to the effect you say that his earlier career was concentrated on economic policy. And he resigned from the Macmillan government, didn't he?
Yes, he did. I can't remember if it was 57 or 58. And his complaint was that the government was just spending without control.
Yes.
And, well,
I'm
always...
sure that if you compared it with governments now, it would be nothing, but which is rather poignant almost.
Well, yes. Yes, I mean, we'll avoid that argument about why we haven't had hyperinflation since 2008.
Yeah.
Which I don't understand. And it ought to be there, but it's not. Yeah. And of course, there's always that argument that goes, I mean, if government is borrowing, that will lead to inflation. And I always wonder why that is. I'm sure there's... I think there's a few steps missing in that. At some point, someone has to get out the printing presses, it seems to me, and start creating the stuff. But anyway... yes, he did resign. That is something of the story of his career. He is a serial resigner.
He did believe passionately in ideas, didn't he?
Yes, yes, he did.
And he's quite explicit about it, that ideas are what really matter. And he's very big on what he calls bad ideas and very keen to expound good ones, and he regards office as a comparatively trivial thing by comparison.
Yes, I think that's true.
And
I think
in a way, I think I don't want to wrench it into the here and now, but Steve Baker MP strikes me as a character of a rather similar type in this respect. Not in all respects, but when it comes to the relative importance of speaking your mind from the backbenches compared to getting onto the front benches and putting up with being muzzled, in effect.
Yes. I mean, it has to be said that Steve Baker does it in a very different way from Powell.
Oh, yes. But there's the same bookishness, the same thoughtfulness, the same belief in ideas.
I'm sure that's true. I suspect Baker would accept he's not perhaps as original as Powell. And I think very few people would argue they were as intelligent as Powell.
He's pretty bright.
Yes, I think so, yes. I'm not...
Yes, and Powell, what the sort of thing that was said about Powell by his enemies was that they would say things like the definition of madness, or mad people are those who have forgotten everything except their reason, who've lost everything except their reason, and they accused Powell of kind of deducing his way into a kind of state of insanity. That was what they accused him of.
Yes, there is some sort of quote on that.
They didn't accuse him of being illogical. They accused him of taking logic way beyond its proper bounds.
Is that true? I mean, one of the things about Powell,
recounting an accusation, not saying it's true.
I think Powell was quite careful, because the fascinating thing about him is his conclusions tend to be very conservative. And one of the hilarious things was that in 1968, the government tried to reform the House of Lords. This was in the days when we still had hereditary peers. And you would have thought that would have just gone through on the nod. But Powell campaigned against it. The front benches attempted a stitch-up, which involved, I think, the creation of lots of life peerages nominated by the front benches. And that brought in the left of the Labour Party, people like Michael Foot, in alliance with Powell, and they actually managed to defeat this. A measure that I think is more or less has come to pass now.
The leftists didn't want all this tidal wave of centre-right placemen.
I guess that would be the reason. I guess that would be a reason. Heffer may go on for 900 pages, but he doesn't quite explain why people like Michael Foot had the opinion they did. Indeed, I was going to just... even when he was... He lost his seat in 1987, and Margaret Thatcher was desperate to give him a peerage, but he wouldn't accept a life peerage. Only an hereditary would do.
I wondered about that, because it was very noticeable that he didn't get given a peerage. I often wondered why that was. It was because he would only accept a hereditary
peerage. Yes, he regarded that as the only...
Did he have any children?
He had two daughters.
Ah.
And I think the rules are that daughters can't succeed. or what was at the time.
Maybe a nephew or somebody would have got it. Who knows?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, I wouldn't have been a nephew because he's an only son. Mm. Only child. Anyway, that is just a prime example. And this was a time he was out of Parliament. He desperately wanted to be a parliamentarian again because he loved it.
Yes.
But he wouldn't do it because he just regarded this as wrong. I find that extraordinary. And I think about by that stage he'd just given up any sort of sense of compromise, and he'd just do what he believed to be right, no matter what the consequences were.
Well, I think it reinforces the point that nothing mattered to him as much as his right to speak his mind and communicate what he really believed. And he didn't just do this by saying eloquent things. He did it by refusing things he regarded as bad, even though they would have been personally very comfortable for him. And he would in lots of ways have enjoyed it and thrived. That just drives the point home, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't entirely without tactical nous. He restricted the number of rebellions he was engaged in any one time.
Yes. You said some interesting things about his army career when we were discussing this beforehand, as we do. He joined the army as a at the bottom. Is that right?
Yes. Well, the situation was that he was engaged in an academic career. He was a graduate of Greek from Cambridge. He became a professor in Australia. This would be 1938 when he was 26. But he writes at the outset of Hitler coming to power, he realised there was going to be a war with Germany. And when he took up his chair at, I can't remember which university it was, he said, look, the day war breaks out, I'm off. And he was true to his word. And his view was that his intention was to get killed in this war. So he enlisted as a private. But the British Army very quickly figured out that this guy has other things to do and had other uses. So they put him into intelligence. Which meant that he was never going to be anywhere near the front lines for fear he would be captured. So he never got the chance, but he was good enough to rise to the rank of brigadier by the end of the war.
Yes, they don't hand those out with the lunch packs, do they?
Certainly not to people who people who weren't in the army before the war. No. Or very very rarely.
Well, that would fit the sort of intensely logical and just very cerebral nature of the man.
Yes.
Wouldn't
it? Yes. And the hard-working nature of the man, too.
Oh, yes.
That's important to realise.
Yes.
I mean, at Cambridge, he hardly ever socialised.
Mm.
He was just, in his books, doing his stuff.
How many books did he himself write?
I don't know. You probably have a better idea because you've got the
well,
two in front of you.
I should have by now, but I've been diverted into other activities in the last week or two, and I never found out. I was hoping you would be able to tell me. These books I've got are, I think there's two. One is, I'll tell you what they are. One is called Freedom and Reality, and I think that is by Powell in the sense that it's a collection of essays based on speeches he made with commentary, and that's quite a substantial book, and it's 300 and more pages long. And the other is A Nation or No Nation, and it's said to be by Enoch Powell, again edited by a different man this time, again I think the same format. So it's sort of a book he wrote.
What's the publisher?
It took me a while to work out what they meant by editing, but I think that just meant helped with it. It's the publisher in both cases is, hang about, I've got an old-fashioned phone where you have to hold it. These two books are published by different publishers. They don't really look like that, but because they're both in the same format in the cover. But one of them is by, published by, forgive me, I've got it here. This is A Nation or No Nation, and it's published by Paper Fronts. And the other book, which is called Freedom and Reality, is published... Oh, Paper France again. Sorry, I'm wrong. They're both the same one.
Right. I've never heard of that publisher.
No, nor have I. I think that's typical Powell. He probably would have submitted it to a bigger publisher. The bigger publisher said, do you think you could tone this down? And the answer was no. I'm guessing.
Yeah.
But that would fit, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
The reason I've got these books at all is because when I worked at the alternative bookshop, Enoch Powell would attend and address events and do book signings and things. He was a very courteous, very easy man to deal with, very kind, very very easy to get along with and work with. I don't think that proves much. I'm not one of these people who derives from personal character political qualities, because time and again the best politicians have a way of turning out to be less than perfect people in one way or another, and vice versa. Often the most delightful people turn out to be politically pernicious in their consequences. So I don't draw any conclusions from that. But again, I would compare him with Steve Baker, who made a similarly very good impression on me, for whatever that may be worth. I've met both of these men, and although very different in their manner, both very kind personally and skilled politicians in the sense of being good at communicating with others with different views.
I mean, it strikes me that Steve Baker is a slightly more behind-the-scenes sort of guy.
Yes, although you never know, that may change. But yes, for the time being, that has been the case, no question. But the other thing, when you were saying that Powell managed to defeat the hereditary peerage thing by creating a kerfuffle which the left then joined in on the side he wanted, so to speak, that's the kind of thing Steve Baker is now doing. He leads a backbench dissident group of conservative MPs who are protesting against the severities of lockdown, and there's every chance. I believe the Labour Party has now come out against vaccine passports.
Really? Wow.
I may be exaggerating a tweet, but the point is, whether that's true or not, it points out, I hadn't expected to be talking about the comparisons between these two men, but I think they're very real. It's quite interesting.
I mean, the comparison I was going to bring up was him and Margaret Thatcher.
Because I agree, of course. Go on.
They were, well, they're not, their pomps, so to speak, are in different periods, about sort of 10 years apart. But you wonder, could Margaret Thatcher have done what she did if Powell hadn't laid the groundwork? And I suspect not, because he laid this fantastic groundwork for her. And you do wonder, because what happened was he refused to stand as a Conservative in the February 1974 election. And then he got a seat as a Unionist in the October 1974 election. So he was out of the picture at the moment when Margaret Thatcher launched her coup attempt at Heath and unseated him. And I think a lot of people were wondering, well, had Enoch not taken this view in 1974, would Thatcher have become leader of the party? And
I certainly think that Thatcher's economic policies owe something to Powell, because there's nothing like having a very public argument, losing it at the time, and then later people thinking, you know, he was right, we should have done this or that.
Yeah. So
that can lead the way for somebody else.
Having said that, it's amusing that when Margaret Thatcher did become Prime Minister, Powell was asked what he thought of the prospect, and he just said grim. Powell had missed that Thatcher had absorbed most of the ideas that he had been promulgating, and that she meant it. I think he badly misunderestimated it. And I think he continued to do so. I seem to remember a TV interview with him. This would have been in about 1990, and he was asked about Margaret Thatcher's understanding of economics. And he said, well, I thought she did the right things, but I don't think she understood it. Which I thought was incredibly...
patronising?
Yes, patronising. Yes, possibly.
Do you think it might have had something to do with her conduct over Europe, which we ought to mention as well? Because Powell was a very early opponent of what is now the European Union and what he saw would become the European Union or try to become the European Union.
Yes, I mean, he wasn't that early because he took his time in 63 in that application. He was in favour. And it took him a while to realise...
That's because he favoured a common market,
I am not absolutely sure on that one.
Or didn't have a problem with a common market, put it that way.
No, he wouldn't have done, no.
It was only when he thought it wasn't going to remain a common market
that he turned against it. Yes, he read the Treaty of Rome. That's what he probably did.
Well, that's typical of him, isn't it? That he would read the thing.
Yeah.
Whereas your typical backbench MP would just kind of, what's it say, and ask his mate, what about it? No, it seems all right to me.
Well, I remember this at the time of Maastricht, because I was working for an MP who was interested in this sort of thing. And it's a real bugger to read.
Yes.
Not least because the Maastricht Treaty itself was a whole bunch of amendments. As published, it was a whole bunch of amendments. It took some nice people in the West Country to actually put this all together and to display the treaty as it would be after Maastricht was passed. And it's a pain in the arse to go through. So, yeah, I'm not surprised a lot of MPs don't read it. But it took Powell to understand the
implications. You're not surprised Powell did, are you?
No,
That's the sort of man he was. And you can imagine him being, when he was back, being an intelligence officer, reading right through things which others would just skim through. And as a result, he got to be a brigadier. So,
I think also apparently organisation was a big part in this. How that is, I don't know. And I suspect he also drove his subordinates as hard as he drove himself, which is...
You also suspect that he would have obviously signed all kinds of Official Secrets Act, and he was the kind of person who took such promises with complete seriousness.
Yeah.
He would stick to them and take secrets galore to his grave.
Yes, I haven't quite... I mean, I'm up to about 1974 in this biography. Ah. So I haven't got to 1982 in the Falklands War. But I believe he was privy to, the sensitive information because he was a Privy Councillor. I'm not quite sure when he became a Privy Councillor.
Well, I do remember in the Falklands War, just after it, they produced a TV play about it. And there's a scene where Powell confronts Margaret Thatcher in the Commons. He's not part of the cabinet, of course. And he says something like, the Honourable Lady has been awarded the sobriquet of the Iron Lady. The country is about to learn, this house is about to learn of what metal she is truly made. And then there's sort of meaningful eye contact, and then we're on to the next scene. But that was Powell's attitude. I think he was in favour of that expedition, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think he was. He had some subtle views on NATO and the Cold War, as I understand it.
His views on British foreign policy were rather interesting, I think. They pre-echoed Trump in the sense of not wanting us to try to punch beyond our weight.
No, exactly that. He thought that was absurd. He was an imperialist until the day that the announcement was that India was going to be made independent. And according to the biography, that night he spent just wandering the streets of London, occasionally sitting in doorways and with his head in his hands. Because to him, India becoming independent was the end of the empire. That was it.
Yes, yes. And I think his attitude was, whatever I might feel or hope, the empire is at an end.
Yes.
And so we can't have any policies based on pretending that we can somehow keep it going.
Yes, yes.
Too late. Yeah.
And
that was his attitude.
And he spotted that before a lot of other people. And so in the 60s, when the whole East of Suez... Now, I mean, I find the East of Suez argument just bizarre. The idea that Britain should be keeping troops in Aden and Malaysia and God knows where else in the Indian Ocean. And so did Powell. And it was a sort of delusion that a lot
of... I think the reason British politicians do this is because they want to make sure we don't antagonise America, and America quite likes us doing this.
Yes, this would have been the time of Vietnam.
Powell also had a very interesting attitude towards America, didn't he? He was much less pro-American than your typical Tory placeman.
Yes, I think this goes back to his time in the war. Mm. I think he could see that America wanted to sort of, you know, push Britain out of the way and didn't have much time for the British Empire.
Oh, none at all.
No. Although he seems to have enjoyed his trips to America, or at least the one trip I've read about. No, he must have gone on multiple trips to America over the years.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but he was much more... He was sceptical of Britain's place as a sort of bag man for America in the same sort of way that he was sceptical of the European Union. I think he had both of those projects in the same category of post-imperial delusion, of trying to be bigger than we were.
Mm.
With India going, we were now a European country, you know.
Yes, which you would think might lead to
France or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
And we should stop imagining that there's any shortcut back into the big time.
Yes.
That I think, was how he felt about both the attachment to the EU, which many British politicians speak about as a sort of new empire for them to play in, and by the same token, believing that by attaching ourselves to America, we could achieve a sort of pseudo great power status.
Yes, I always hate that phrase, the special relationship.
Well, yes, and he would have been very sceptical of that, wasn't he?
I can't find any remark he's made about that particular phrase, but yeah, it seems to be, yeah, as you say, he did not believe in a shortcut back to glory.
And sooner or later, we're going to have to get to grips with his rivers of blood speech before we end this conversation. And it's worth pointing out that also his view of immigration was that it was part of an attitude towards the British Commonwealth that was unsustainable because of its logical consequences.
Yes, he felt, indeed. That's right, actually.
Another of these fantasies, post-imperial fantasies.
Yeah.
The reason why Labour was in favour of mass immigration, well, Blair kind of said it, didn't he, later? It was so that we can sort of get different citizens who can vote for us, you know. But why did the Conservatives go along with it? Answer, because they liked the idea of the British Commonwealth.
With the Union Jack still fluttering over it, nonsense.
The Queen still wandering around being the Queen everywhere.
Yeah.
And if the price of that was that northern cities of England would be stuffed to bursting with foreigners, as Powell saw it, well, so be it. And I think what we're discovering in this conversation, or what we're reminding ourselves of, is the immense coherence of his thinking.
I was actually going to say that in immigration, I think there's a lack of coherence, in fact.
Well, I think immigration was coherent. What I'm saying is there is a definite connection between
his views on America, on the EU,
on the Commonwealth, and immigration.
That's
what I'm getting at. I'm not saying that everything he thought fitted together perfectly. I'm saying that everything he thought was, in his mind, connected. And I think it often was.
He's a smart chap, so I'm sure he would be a man who
would be happy with a straight-out contradiction between two of the things he thinks and says.
No.
That's not how he behaved.
Well, I've certainly struggled for decades with the idea that, A, I'm a libertarian, B, I'm opposed to mass migration.
Yes.
You'd think, logically, it seems that you should be in favour of open borders if you're a libertarian.
My problem is just sheer dumb ignorance. I don't know what life is like in these places where the bulk of mass immigration has happened. We've discussed this before. We've talked about diversity. Do you remember when we were contrasting London with other parts of the UK? And in London, racial harmony seems to prevail. I mean, there are parts of the East End where there are so many Bangladeshis that you wonder. But mostly it's reasonably harmonious. I mean, occasionally you get upsurges of knife crime associated with the Labour mayors who don't care about the police and helping them. But it's pretty reasonable. In London, it doesn't feel like it's a catastrophe or a transformation for the worse. It's certainly different. But I don't know what I'd feel if I lived if I'd lived most of my life in Wigan or Doncaster or some such place. And I almost wish I knew what these places were like, because I think then you could have a clearer idea of whether Powell was right or whether he was being too pessimistic.
Well, I mean, well, I'll start at the beginning, and I hope this is relevant. His views on immigration, it seems to me, were entirely or almost entirely based on what he saw in his own constituency and the tensions.
And that was, by the way, can we just clarify what his constituency was? It was Birmingham, wasn't it?
Wolverhampton, east or southwest, I can't remember which one it was. But there was large-scale immigration and lots of people didn't like it. And that led to nastiness on both sides. And he felt this was a bad thing. But I don't think he ever really came up with a sort of a formula for this. You know, how much immigration do you have? I mean, he did make some sort of remark about, well, 10,000 is fine, 100,000 is probably okay. 1 million, I'm starting to worry, 10 million is a disaster. In terms of
he has a point, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
Numbers do matter very, very much.
Yes.
In these sorts of discussions. Nevertheless, with the wisdom of hindsight and having lived longer than Enoch Powell did, we can see that certainly in parts of Britain, things are calming down. I mean, colourblindness is becoming a fact.
You think? I was very disturbed by these BLM protests last year. I felt this, and the wokeism and the rise of anti-white racism in universities. It seems to me, if they have come to dominate the universities, it's only a matter of time before it starts spreading.
I don't have direct knowledge of British universities, but people who do tell me that this is wildly exaggerated. The influence and presence of wokeism. What people in universities have a habit of saying, apparently, is in our university, it's not a problem. I believe it is in others, but it's not in ours. And they all say that. In other words, the woke people have managed to make themselves seem a lot bigger and more forceful than they really are.
Except Glenn Reynolds, who does not say that. And he is a professor, of course.
Yeah, well, America, I think, is a bit different. I think America always lurches from extreme to extreme more extremely than we do.
Yes, these ideas certainly tend to originate in America, but I can't think of any ideas that originated in America that which didn't cross the Atlantic at some point.
Oh yes, they get here, but quite how much impact they have is something else again. Anyway, that the relevance of all this is it's Powell was sort of right that there was turmoil going on in the short run, but in the longer run, there is at least room for optimism that things are calming down, it seems to me. And one of the most interesting ways in which people are becoming colorblind is that they're doing exactly what Enoch Powell said you shouldn't do, which is they're simply not talking about it. They're concealing the amount of racial animosity that used to happen in the world. And when their children ask about it, they just evade it. Rather like
they
soldiers
do?
Who had a tricky war not talking about it, you know, that sort of thing. I think a lot of middle-class families proclaim virtues that that they kind of maybe more or less grudgingly admit are virtues. And as a result, the children grow up just not seeing a problem. I may be desperately London-centred here, but I get the feeling that London kids just aren't bothered about this.
It is,
and that's because they've been raised by people who pretended they weren't bothered by this, who decided to pretend that they weren't. In other words, what Powell says is you've got to talk about these things. And what the British middle classes and educated classes said is, no, you haven't. You've got to not talk about it and just pretend it isn't a problem. And then it will become true that it isn't.
I think I'm with Powell, actually.
Yes.
I'm worried about things you don't talk about.
Yes.
I think things
yes.
can fester in that environment. Mm-hmm. It is perhaps at a tangent here, but it's interesting to read Tommy Robinson's opinions on these sorts of things, because Robinson grew up in a multiracial town, and to him it's just the way it is. So it's nothing, that's entirely normal. His objection was solely with Islam, because he felt that was... he could see that it was incompatible. It took him a while to figure out why.
If you don't talk about Islam, that doesn't stop people being Muslims. But if you don't talk about racial problems, then there's a decent chance that nobody will notice it.
There's been a lot of talking in the last year, shall we say.
Yeah, but I interpret that differently as the left, having said the trouble with capitalism is that it's racist, the response of normal people was, yeah, I think they've got a point. Capitalism was very racist. Let's stop it being racist. Let's stop being racists and let's stop talking about racism and pull ourselves together and become colorblind. And the left then had to find another way of picking a fight with normal life, because that's their modus operandi. They spend their whole time complaining. And their complaint is that colorblindness is itself racism. It's kind of denialism of the past, which it kind of is. But it's the best way to deal with it, in my opinion. I'm not sure it is my opinion, actually. I think I'm putting forward a case which I'm not absolutely sure about, but I'm putting it forward, because Powell very, very consciously and explicitly argued the opposite.
We had to talk about it. And
We have to talk about it.
Yeah.
That was his basic approach to everything, really. You know, we can't just sweep these kind of hostilities under the carpet. We can't just ignore inflation. We can't go on pretending about what a wonderful thing the Commonwealth is. But the truth is, we sort of can. It appears that we can sweep inflation under the carpet for a hell of a long time. And Britain's exit from the European Union was based on a kind of colorblind sentimentalism about Britain's place in the larger world and about how we could get along very nicely just by being nice to people and trading with them and being colorblind.
I must say that was lost on me at the time. Possibly.
I think the colorblind position is becoming right-wing, in the sense that the left have chased it out of their tribe. They've identified colorblindness as just blindness to reality, to historical wrong that must be righted.
Yes.
And the right-wing of politics has anathematized hardcore racism and has embraced colorblindness. So somebody like Catherine Birbal Singh, who I just watched on Twitter this afternoon, has been pointing out that there's lots of racism, and it takes the form of left-wingers denouncing black people who want to think for themselves about the state of racism in Britain.
Yes, yes.
The actual hardcore racism, which, as you rightly pointed out, isn't Tommy Robinson either, although he's probably thought of as being like that amongst people who just don't know what he really thinks, is anathematized, along with it.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so few of them.
Where I would agree with Powell insofar as he said such things, I think you can't just ignore Islam. You can't ignore it into niceness, if you see what I mean.
No.
Can't be done. Part of the process of dealing with Islam is to keep on reminding Muslims what it says in the Quran, and to keep on challenging them and saying, do you really believe this? Because if you do, you're just as bad as the terrorists, and if you don't, well, then will you please stop saying you do? And Powell would never speak like that, because Muslims were British citizens and had votes, so he didn't believe in insulting people's religions the way I just did. But he certainly... I was under the impression that Powell was less concerned about racism and more concerned about the cultural differences between Islam and Britain. And much
I
less
can't
bothered.
Find any but mention of Islam.
You told me that's wrong. Yes.
I can't find any mention. But let's face it, he's a man who talked about lots of issues over his time, and even a 900-page book may not be able to cram all of them in. So,
well, often writers of these 900-page books have a way of steering the book in their preferred direction.
Yeah.
And so if for any reason Heffer doesn't really want to talk about that, because he doesn't want to get involved in a fist fight with Islam, he maybe omits it. Who knows? As so often happens with these conversations, we end up with a question, well, we don't end up, but we throw out a question, a sort of unfinished piece of business on the subject. And in this case, it's the question, did Powell make a big distinction between mere coloured immigration, which he certainly thought was a problem in the sense that his constituents did, but did he regard that as much less pernicious in its long-term effects than the much deeper cultural differences between Islam and the West? It would make perfect sense for him to think like that, because it goes back to his point about the importance of ideas.
I will try to shed some light on that, because he did make a remark about whether he would be worried about large-scale German or Russian immigration. And he said, yes, he would be. I don't know if that helps or not. But the point being, it was a cultural matter rather than a racial matter.
Yes, yes.
I'm not so sure about that myself, because, as you know, I tend to think of things in Northern Irish terms, where you have two tribes who are identical in terms of racial terms, but you know, that still doesn't stop them killing one another. So,
Yes. Well, it's certainly easier to be colourblind about the grandchildren of, e.g., Polish and Italian immigrants into Britain just after the war, if you're not told their surnames.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've got you know, you can be as racist as you want, but you're not going to realize it, you know.
Yeah.
I got to know somebody in the 1980s whose name was Piotr Iglikowski, and his parents were Polish immigrants just after the war. And he was as English as me, you know, in his demeanor and accent and everything, education.
Yeah.
But he hadn't changed his name to Peter Eagledon or something, and when I heard his surname, I thought, oh, that's interesting. But it's much easier for him to assimilate, put it that way, because
yes.
He had assimilated.
Yes.
If there's no colour bar. But I think we're getting to the point where, in large swathes of England, assimilating just means the colour barrier isn't there because, well, it just isn't. And not least because there are so many mixed marriages and what used to be called half caste.
I'm certainly sure that helps.
I think it does.
Yeah, mixed marriages.
Because it makes the tribal division much harder to enforce and to even see. What I mean, where do you put people? It's just, oh, forget it. You know?
Although I find it a bit alarming that our Watford captain, Troy Deeney, who's half and half, has been very vocal in support of this BLM business, which...
Well, I believe that those who support... Most of the people who support BLM support it because they believe that black lives matter. And they do.
Yeah.
What they might not be so keen on supporting is what the people who call themselves Black Lives Matter also believe on other matters. That the way to get rid of racism is to shut down capitalism, which is rubbish on stilts.
And not great if you're a professional footballer.
Not great if you're anything. Certainly
That's
not if
true.
You're a professional
yeah.
footballer. But and what strikes me about the state of racism in Britain is that what black footballers are having to put up with now is rather sums it up well, which is that they get a lot of grief on Twitter from, frankly, maniacs, malevolent racists, but there they are playing Premier League football, you know. So that
heroes to their supporters.
To almost all of the fans who turn up to watch them. Yeah. So in other words, it's not perfect. It's not ideal. There's plenty of boorish maniacs who ought to pipe down. But that hasn't stopped them achieving huge social advancement. And whereas for a long time this sort of thing was confined to sporting prowess, as the years go by, it becomes very clear that the reason for that is that simply younger people, sportsmen peak younger. So you're going to register the first upward social mobility of black and brown people in sport before you notice it in, you know, the legal profession or politics or, indoor jobs, company directors, that kind of thing. But there are gradually now being... There are now top-flight football managers who are black, aren't there?
One or two.
Not many, but there are going to be more.
Yes.
That's because their average age is older, so it takes a bit longer. And I get it when people say, yes, but it's all taking a hell of a long time, but this sort of thing does take up. At least it takes time for the people who grew up, as I nearly did, in an age where racism was routine... to just die out. And I think Powell, I think he was rather too pessimistic about this kind of process, and that what you might call the silent majority of conservative MPs on the subject of race relations, which is, oh, don't let's talk about it, dear boy, let's discuss the economy and the health service and education and all these things, and just not bang on about coloured people. I think they had a point, those people. It's not the only way to solve problems, to just not discuss them, but it can be the way to deal with it.
It seems to me in my lifetime we've discussed very few... Well, we've obviously discussed other things, but race has been a pretty central issue. People talk about it all the time.
I think they do in politics, but do they in everyday life?
No, I don't think they do.
That's what I'm talking about. I mean...
My goddaughter...
And I did some socialising recently, and she was with a guy who was from the West Indies, and I could feel myself rather self-consciously not discussing the colour of his skin, because I don't believe in discussing the colour of his skin, even though...
Well, it's not much to discuss, really, is there?
No, and it's insulting.
Yeah.
Although I was raised in a household where that would be the first thing you'd notice. Because there were no coloured people living in our village, apart from the family across the road. That was it. And we sure as hell noticed what colour they were. But colour blindness literally means what it says. And I'm in favour of it. And if I can't do it for real, I can at least fake it and be polite about it. And that's, I think, my central disagreement with J. Enoch Powell.
I'll have to have a think about that.
Well, that is rather the point of these things, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
I mean, we had a similar kind of contrast of opinion when we discussed diversity in one of the earlier ones of these things.
Yeah.
You can perhaps put a link back to that one in the notes for this one. It would make sense.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose I just take a very pessimistic view on this.
That's interesting, I think. Sorry, you were saying.
Yeah, I just take a very pessimistic view on this. It seems to me that we're going the same way as Northern Ireland. Mm. I think the left are very successful in this. I mean, by the way, I think the left will be very unsuccessful eventually. They will succeed in starting some sort of low-level race war and then get kicked out of both sides.
Yes.
And into irrelevance.
Yes. I don't think that is likely to happen. I think the difference between race... and religion is that with religion you can sign up 100% to one side or the other, no matter how you started. But with race, you're kind of what you are. And if you're going to have tribes based on color of skin, it's a real problem if a large number of people can't easily be classified into one tribe or the other. In other words, it's a very it these mixed race people are very good news for optimists like me, because they make tribalism less likely to happen in the future on the scale you've suggested. Whereas religious tribalism, nationality, anything where you can join if you want to, that can very suddenly turn viciously tribal, can't it?
Exactly. I mean, we're talking about sort of the religious wars of the 17th century and
Yugoslavia recently, where these things were calming down.
I don't think that had it. Do you think that really had anything to do with religion? I mean, Northern Ireland, for instance, has nothing to do with religion.
It wasn't religion. It was nationality.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not quite sure what the nationality is like.
Thing. That's a hard thing to decide you're going to change. You can't say, I'm not a Kosovo Serb or something. The answer comes back, yes, you are. It's like saying, I'm not a Jew. Yes, you are, is the answer that comes back from the people wanting to stir up a tribal battle.
Yes, and if they say, you're white,
I mean, the Nazis hated Mendelssohn just because Mendelssohn was raised as a Christian, the composer, I mean. Yes, he was raised as Christian, but it was all a fake. You know, as far as the Nazis were concerned, that didn't matter a damn. He had ancestors who were Jewish, and that was enough to damn him.
And what does that say about white people?
Race, you can be genuinely mixed. It really doesn't make sense to talk about somebody who's three-quarters white in his grandparentage and one-quarter black as being completely one or completely the other.
Well, the Nazis managed it. I mean, that's what they did.
I mean, let me put it this way. I can remember when I was at school being given short stories by W. Somerset Maugham to read, and these were stories that dated from a time that really was tribal and places that really were tribal, namely the British Empire. And in these stories, there were these people called, I've mentioned this earlier, but it's all coming back to me. There are people called half-castes who are neither one thing nor the other, poor, tragic little creatures that they were. And I remember one where, simply because this person was not black and not white, but some sort of white coffee version of skin colour, committed suicide, just walked out into the sea and drowned himself. And when I think of how completely that sort of biography doesn't happen now, I just think, thank God, we've come on a lot since those bad old days. You know, being a racially mixed person now is just life. It's no more bizarre than being a redhead. Okay, you may get some stupid idiots on Twitter going on at you, but normal people don't make an issue of it.
That's true. And I would say.
I think so. I think most people.
War is a collective activity. And what we may think about people individually, unfortunately, when war starts, we start thinking about them collectively.
Yeah.
Those bloody Germans, for instance.
And
you have to.
The Bosch.
Unfortunately.
Yes.
I mean, I think what both of us would like is a world in which we can treat people on an individual basis. And to hell with the colour of their skin.
Yes.
But I think we may not get to decide.
Yeah, oh, quite. I mean, neither of us, I'm certainly not going to decide any of these things. But it's worth alluding to the broader cultural or global context of all this. I mean, for about 500 years, let's be blunt about it, white people have been making the running. Because white Europe, for all sorts of reasons that we've argued about in different conversations we've had and thought about, broke into the industrial revolution. They had their industrial explosions before the black people did. And I'm afraid white people generally were in the habit of concluding that one of the reasons this happened was because they were superior. I mean, I can remember these times.
Well, you would, wouldn't you? I mean, it's not a difficult thing to think.
Something. So I do. And, you know, can you forgive people for this? Well, you sort of can. I mean, it's not an unreasonable guess as to why we're doing better than them. But I remember, for example, one particular habit that Southeast Asians in particular seem to have, which was that every now and again they would do something called running amok, and often this would involve a weapon and killing people. And
sorry, when was this? Feeling, I've never heard of this.
This was in the 1950s, this sort of thing. We would hear stories of...
I mean, would it be sort of a collective business or just an individual?
No, an individual would just go mad and just lose his rag and start killing people. And after he'd killed about three or four, maybe 10 or 11, somebody would kill him and that would be the end of that. And the general opinion among all the white people I had any dealings with, well, that's what Asians are like. You know, they do these things. We're us and we don't behave like that. Well, those times have changed, haven't they?
Serial killing is a running amok.
Not just serial killers, but trying to murder, get a big body count all in one attack in the space of a couple of hours. You know, the Hungerford massacre, for example.
Yeah.
What was that one in Dunblane? Mm. I mean, they're not very common in Britain, but they are starting to happen, you know. And so there's another reason why white people can't any longer feel superior to Asian people. And what I mean is, and get away with it, because it just doesn't work anymore as an argument. And it takes time for these sorts of eras to change.
Yes, yes.
But they do.
We tend to form our opinions in our early 20s, or by our early 20s, and
yes,
we stick with them. Yeah, that's true.
Yes. And as I get older, I realise I've got no right to expect the world to remain the same. It's sort of almost unnatural. Why would it?
Yeah.
That's not the way it works.
And it's
certainly not the way it works now.
And it's changing very quickly.
Yes.
You find.
And if not in different ways at different times. I mean, a good example is the way that England was absolutely transformed between about the years 1840 and 1870 by the railways. It wasn't immigrants. It wasn't people being different. It was life being profoundly different at the end of it to what it had been at the beginning. I mean, it was bigger than the arrival of the internet from all the things I've read. Because the life that they were leading at the beginning was so different from the sort of life they had at the end, which was a lot like the life we were brought up in. And it all happened within the space of a generation. And there were plenty of people who didn't like it and who said it's all happening too fast. And the thing is, the world is now shrugging off that period, or it's beginning to shrug off the period when white people just were more capable. They made better workers, they were more disciplined, they were more logical, they knew how to write things and all that, blah, 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 all the things that were regarded as arguments for the inherent superiority of white people. All these things are now fading away. That the world is becoming economically more equal, I would say.
I think I'd feel a lot happier about that argument if there were a majority black country where I'd want to live.
Yes.
I can imagine... You know, well, obviously, I mean, Japan, I'd be pretty happy living in, for instance.
So the question of whether they are happy to have you living
well,
there.
Well, indeed, probably not.
Yes.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm probably exaggerating how much this has already changed, but surely this sort of change is now underway, isn't it?
I don't know, is the answer. I mean, so certainly there is an extraordinary decline in the West. I you know, there's no question about that. I mean, China has,
yes,
you know, pulled its socks up to an extraordinary degree.
The West is yeah. Shall we say, first among equals? Put it that way.
Yeah, it's still sort of just like about.
Just about clinging on.
But I think the West's ideas are alarming at the moment.
Yes.
And that, I don't think that's a good thing at all.
No, I agree.
When you read about the extent to which the Chinese Communist Party has penetrated the halls of power,
well, I think all of these confrontations between the West and the rest, or the West and rival ideological blocks, it's not the whole world, don't forget, and the West is more than the West in terms of the number of people who want to go on living like that. I mean, there are plenty of people who believe in quote-unquote Western ideas living all over the world in the sense that they want to live peaceful, prosperous lives. They want politics to be civilized and not tribal slaughters. They think democracy is one of the ways to contrive that outcome. They don't want wars. They don't believe in revolutionary upheavals. In that sense, Westernism is spreading just as strongly as it ever did. But the whole point about...
I mean, do those sorts of people actually help? I'm sure there are lots of people in Russia in 1917 who felt much the same way, but that didn't stop the disaster happening.
Hmm. Well, it's like we always say, it's a numbers thing. If you've got 30% fanatical communists in your midst, you can kiss your country goodbye, basically.
Well, yes.
But 30%, I don't believe we've got anything like 30% wokists. But I suppose the danger is that we will, because of the domination of the universities.
Well, they're doing a pretty good job of it, you'd have to say.
I suspect there may be a lot of people looking on, keeping their heads down, and forming different conclusions to the ones the wokists want them to.
I'm sure there are, but the problem is they are keeping their heads down.
Yes, yes.
And those who pop their head up get a... Yeah, we have indeed.
Yeah, we have.
Yeah. Is there anything more we could say about
Powell? I think one other aspect of Powell's career that's interesting is the cancellation of Powell that definitely did happen.
There was?
Well, what I mean by that is not that nobody'd heard of him or was unable to find out about his opinions, but that if you intended to say something polite and truly complimentary about the man, you'd better watch out for your job. And I think that may even still be true now.
When was that?
Well, I think it's true now. I think if you go into an office and you say, I've been reading a biography of Enoch Powell and I think he's a very splendid man in lots of ways, you could get yourself some grief, you know? Not because of what Powell was actually like, but because once Powell is established as a bogeyman, then if you say you actually quite like him, that makes you a bogeyman.
And that's like a sort of Emmanuel Goldstein character.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, Tommy Robinson's the same thing now, isn't
he? Yes.
It's not indeed. That Tommy Rob... People don't... If you say, I agree with Tommy Robinson, and I do more than I do with Powell, actually, especially in the light of what you said about mixed race, but his beef is with Islam, that's my... I agree with Tommy Robinson about this. But I have to have a pretty privileged sort of social life to be able to get away with saying such a thing.
Hmm. I think Powell had an easier time than Tommy Robinson.
Yes. Yes, I mean, he was on the fringes of being a life peer. If he was offered one, yes.
Yeah, he was in the papers.
Nobody's going to offer Tommy Robinson a life peerage or something.
No time soon, although you never know.
But the particular feature of all this is this very convoluted argument that goes, you like Enoch Powell, that makes you a monster. And your answer is, but you're assuming Enoch Powell was a monster, therefore if I like him, I must be. But you're wrong, he wasn't a monster. Let me tell you about him. It's the willingness to be even wrongly accused of being a monster is something that most people don't have, because they've got lives they have to lead. That's what's so nasty about cancel culture.
Yeah.
Even if you've got an argument that Powell, for example, wasn't a racist in any straightforward sense, and I don't think he was, certainly not in the pernicious sense.
For example, just to prove this point, I got a couple of examples I will give. One, I mean, during the war, he had an Indian colleague, and he was trying to get him a bed in an officer's mess somewhere, and you know. He couldn't, because they wouldn't allow it.
Yes.
Because he's an Indian. Yes. And there is a photograph in this biography of him, you know, chatting away with some of his Asian constituents.
Yes.
So, I mean, you know, it's just absurd to accuse of that. And he was always very insistent that any immigrant to the country should have exactly the same rights as a native.
Yes, I've been skimming these books I've mentioned, but that I did encounter again and again, that notion. Well, you see what I mean? If you're saying, but Powell wasn't a racist, then you're kind of a monster because you even dare to defend this man that we all now agree was a monster. And if you challenge that, you're a pariah. And that seems to me the particular quality of cancel culture that I most detest about it. It's this knowing, it's the truth doesn't matter. What matters is social cohesion and agreement. And if you're defecting from the tribe, then you die. You know, that sort of mentality. Then yes. You can't join our club. You're signalling your indifference to our concerns, which you sort of are, aren't you?
I guess possibly not. But yeah, go on.
No, I'd finish.
Yeah, finish. Okay, right.
Anything else?
I don't know if there's anything else. No.
I think we've covered most of it.
Yeah.
There is, I suppose, one question.
I mean, maybe we did actually cover it, actually. I was going to say about a libertarian in politics. I mean, I know we agreed he wasn't a libertarian, but he's jolly close, I'd say.
Mm. Well, one of the books I've got in front of me was edited by somebody called John Wood. Now, I think that is the John Wood who was deeply associated with the Institute of Economic Affairs, because his economic agenda was basically their agenda.
Right.
So, and John Wood was very happy to support the alternative bookshop. You know, he was one of the people who made that happen, so to speak. So there is an overlap. There's no denying it. No point in denying it.
No. Well, maybe we are done there.
I am, and if you are, then I guess we are.
Okay, we'll stop.
Right.